Quick disclaimer, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and should not be construed as an offer to buy or sell any securities or to make or consider any investment or course of action. For more information, go to bestevershow.com.
You cannot build a portfolio in 1 year. You have to invest yourself. You have to learn about the industry. You have to keep on top of all the information available in the market data. And you have to always look at it from a long-term play on what you're trying to build over the next 10 to 15 years.
Welcome to the Best Ever Show, the world's longest-running daily commercial real estate podcast. Our hosts interview commercial real estate experts every day to get you the best advice ever with none of the fluffy stuff.
Hello, best ever listeners. Welcome to the Best Real Estate Investing Advice Ever Show. I'm Ash Patel, and I'm with today's guest, Hait Patel. Hait is joining us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hait is responsible for acquisitions and underwriting for the DeRosa Group, where he identifies markets and properties. They purchase limited service hotels and multifamily properties. Hait's portfolio consists of 1,600 multifamily units, and they are expanding to new development and hospitality. Hait, thank you for joining us, and how are you today?
Good. Thank you for having
me. It's our pleasure. And DeRosa Group is Matt Faircloth, a good friend of the show. How long have you been working with Matt?
It's going to be about 2 years here in a couple months. It's been a very exciting journey. Since we joined, we have ventured into hospitality now. I brought that expertise over.
I want to dive into a lot today, but a couple things. One, best ever listeners, Hait Patel, we're not related. Patel is a very common last name, but I had the pleasure of meeting him at the Best Ever Conference, and we started talking about his background in hotels. Can we just kick off with that?
Yeah, we can jump right into it. So we as a family moved to America in 2006. My parents bought a small motel in 2008 in a small town in South Dakota. And that's where we started working, basically in sixth grade, seventh grade, helping parents however we could. After that, I did work at a couple other properties in the area. And hotels, I guess, are kind of in my blood. I can call up 7 to 10 people right now if I need any sort of advice or any sort of procurement needs. So it's very easy on that front. But as far as my background in hospitality, I built a portfolio of about six properties. We had a couple country inns. We had Quality Inn, Super 8, and we had a Holiday Inn Express and a Fairfield. I've also done consulting work on helping friends and family doing their renovations on Marriott and Hilton products as well. I helped on a couple Town Place projects and just one Hilton product. So my roles I have assumed are asset management, hands-on property management, GM of the property as well, and overall financing and debt as well.
Hey, it's the great immigrant story, right? I'm assuming when your parents came here, they had friends in the hotel business?
Yeah, we had family and friends in the hotel business. So there's a lot of help from their end to identify which hotel we bought. But unsuccessfully, we bought a property in 2008. So we had a lot of hardship for the next 5-6 years to gain everything back and get back into the cycle.
And that's why it was all hands on deck. And then sixth grade, you guys were working in the hotel. I'm assuming you learned a tremendous amount, but at the same time, you weren't jaded because a lot of kids that grew up in a family business want nothing to do with it when they get older, but you enjoyed it, right? Because you went on to build your own portfolio.
Yes, I definitely enjoyed it. Right after college, I did dabble into a bit of the insurance side of things. I worked in underwriting on the insurance side because I like numbers and I like analytics. I wanted to pursue the route of being an actuary at that point, just because it involves a lot of management decisions, looking at financial aspect of the company, as well as how much we're lending out on the premium side. So I did dabble into that, but similar to you, office structure, the bureaucracy just didn't fit very well. So then I had the opportunity to grow a portfolio for my family and friends, and that's what I did.
You followed the typical game plan, especially for immigrants, where it's you come here, you get educated, go the corporate route, and you realize it wasn't for you. Same path I took, but it took me 15 years to actually get out of the corporate world. So tell me about your first hotel that you bought on your own.
The first hotel we bought was a Quality Inn. So when you look at most Quality Inns, I'm sure in the Ohio area and New Jersey area where you're from, they're typically going to be an exterior quarter property, probably 1980s, 1990s in that range built. The one we bought particularly was an old Fairfield, which was converted to Quality Inn. And that's why we pursued it, because it was an interior corridor. a 65 room property with an elevator, and that was fit our buy box perfectly. It was a JV deal, so we had SBA lending on it as well. And folks that are not familiar with SBA, you know, Small Business Association, they help you on retail side of things. I'm sure your tenants utilize SBA lending. So we can also utilize SBA lending on the hotel side of things as well. So our loan to value on SBA looks a lot more attractive. They can go upwards of 85%. So we utilized that. We had a small JV group, and that was our first acquisition. It was doing about $1 million in revenue. We did the renovation ourselves, and we grew the revenue to about $1.4 million, and we sold it off after 2 years.
Hey, I really am excited about this conversation because I want to demystify hotels for a lot of our listeners. When you go to sell a hotel property, does it follow the same rules with cap rate and NOI?
Hotels, there's multiple ways to look at a property. You can do what is a revenue multiplier. So if your property is doing, let's say, $1 million revenue, depending on the location and property and the franchise associated with it, the revenue multiplier might be 4x, so it might be worth $4 million. You can also do cap rates. You know, cap rates are going to be for Hilton or IHG and Marriott products. You're probably looking at 8 to 10 cap, depending on how much renovation is needed. Otherwise, on the economy side, like if you're looking at a Motel 6, the cap rate might be 12 to 14 in that range. So you can utilize that. You can also utilize price per key. The property's underperforming, let's say the NOI is not there, you're likely going to buy it on a price per key matrix. So there's different ways to analyze a deal when you're looking at hospitality.
And that revenue multiplier, that's what's most often used, right? 2 to 3 or 4 times. And that Motel 6 might trade at 2 to 3 times top line revenue, whereas your branded nicer hotels will be closer to 4x revenue. And the one thing that nobody ever talks about when they talk about hotels is the PIP list. Let's just dive into that because look, people think it's rosy, right? Oh, it's got to be an easy business. It's like Airbnb and people just come to you and the franchise company, the flag, does all the marketing for you. But the PIP list never gets talked about. Can you share with the best ever listeners what that is?
Yeah, so PIP is short for Property Improvement Plan. PIPs are issued on a cyclical basis. Some brands do it 7 years, some at 10, and some at 12. For example, if you were to buy a value add deal, which is what we are focusing on, we're primarily looking at assets built after 2005. So if we bought a 2008 property, it's going to have what is called a change of ownership PIP, which are issued by the brand. So let's, for this example, let's say if I'm buying a Hampton by Hilton, which was built in 2008 and 2024, most of the properties go to within the Hilton brand. They're going to be newer. They're going to be renovated properties. So when this PIP is issued, it's going to have a punch list of what you need to do to keep your license. For example, 10 to 15 years, you're going to have to fix up the rooms. You're going to have to renovate the bathrooms. You're going to have to renovate the public areas. So that is what's on the PIP. PIPs takes a lot of time. Some ownership groups prefer doing new developments, so we're doing PIPs just because of the hassle. You know, you're going to see a revenue drop when you're doing a PIP. You're going to get a lot more complaints when you're doing a PIP. Also, the procurement process, the contractors getting them in place, making sure the liabilities are also covered, your liens and everything in place as well. So it's a process. If you're doing a 100-room property, it can take up to 8 months. If it's a property that's generating revenue year-round and you can only renovate, let's say, 5 rooms at a time, it could take up more time.
And let's not sugarcoat it. Basically, when the PIP person from the franchise comes down, that is the equivalent of a city inspector. They're not the happiest people, right? They come in, gun swinging, and it's not like due diligence. They nitpick everything and they just start writing. And then it goes beyond that in that you have to replace generic artwork in the rooms and in the hallways with other generic artwork, but you got to buy it from the franchise vendor who often is associated with the franchise so they get kickbacks. It's a rough process and it's a lot of money.
It is. The average cost of the properties we're looking at right now, the average PIP is going to be around $25,000 to $30,000 per door or per key.
Yeah, amazing.
It used to be back in 2019, we could get away with $15,000 to $20,000 range, but the cost of everything has gone up, labor and furniture, FF&E components. So now it's closer to $25,000 to $30,000. And on the older properties, we also have to do a brand new exterior. So you'll see a lot of Fairfield Inns by Marriott on the market today. And they're requiring you to redo the entire exterior in the porte-cochere area as well. So that adds up to a lot of your costs in the parking lot, And back to your point, yes, we have to order furniture from approved vendors. We have to find those approved vendors, do the bidding, see which one's the most trustworthiness, and break it down between three or four vendors and make our work from there. And yeah, some brands do get a kickback on linens, on furniture. Everything that's logoed gets a little bit of kickback. Yeah. So yeah, it's hard to make it work.
And they often have you replace all the furniture in the rooms, the lighting, the mattresses. They'll have you tile the showers at times. It's like a gut reno almost, similar to apartment renovations.
It is.
So it's not a pleasurable thing to sell a hotel because you have to encounter that pip, right? And the new buyers want you to take care of all of those things or either credit them for the amount that it would take to do that. So you're taking a big hit on the sale.
Yes. There's multiple ways. So we usually have a reserve. Lenders, if you're looking at a CMBS lending, CMBS lenders who require us to have a reserve every year. So if you're doing, for example, you're going to always have a 3-4% reserve based on your revenue. So I want to say if you are going to have a reserve built in over the next 7 years, let's say $1 million to $2 million, you can discount the property by that much amount because you already have that sitting in your reserves and account. So you could do that. You could do the PIP yourself and sell the property as well. But yeah, the exit is very important. On exit, the other component that's important is the franchise itself. I don't think most of the viewers have probably seen Hampton Inns that are older than 30 years because they get kicked out of the system. So if we bought a property that's 2008, usually has a life of 35 to 40 years to be in the upper mid-scale product. So if you're trying to exit a property that's 30 years old, it's going to be a lot more tough. You're going to have to discount it very heavily. Hopefully you've got all of your equity out of the deal and everything. You can discount and make up for that. But it's very important when we are looking at property to assume when we sell, the new owner will be able to get a 15-year term as well. So those are the properties we are targeting right now.
Hey, is that when properties change flags or change brands? They go from a Hampton to a Quality Inn?
Yes, 100%. You're right on there. So you'll see a lot of the Fairfields that are in the market, some of the older residences that are changing flags and likely go to a mid-scale product such as Quality or Mainstay, Wood Springs in that region. And the other thing we're seeing right now is the brands themselves are coming out with the economy segment. So Hilton launched a product called Spark by Hilton, which is the economy segment. So what they're doing to keep their properties in their own pipeline is they're converting old Hamptons into Sparks by Hilton. So they are building their own brands in the economy and mid-scale segment. Marriott did a similar thing. They came out with two brands, one for extended stay and one for economy, mid-scale economy segment. So now there is a bit more flexibility that you're going to be within the Hilton flag. You just won't be a Hampton, you'll be a Spark. But that conversion is still going to cost you a little bit of money.
Yeah, it's not a crappy room. It's all redone and there's a fair amount of renovations for those brands. In terms of increasing NOI, I get you can cut expenses so much, run an efficient operation. How do you increase revenue? Because most of your reservations and guests come from the central booking system, right?
Yes. So there's a couple different streams of revenue you can utilize. So Aduro's and specifically my fundamentals, why I'm looking at value add opportunities is if I do the PIP, I likely see anywhere from 10 to 15% increase in what we call RevPAR, which is just your occupancy times your daily rate. So we are hoping if we are putting in $2-3 million into the property, we are going to be able to increase the rates that way. We can also look at other income, such as if there's no pet fees or anything, we can start collecting those. Rollaway beds can also be utilized as other fee income. If the marketplace at the property is usually brand mandated, so those are usually pretty good. But if there's an option to add just beer or wine, we can also look at those potentials as well. And if there's meeting rooms, how can we sell more of the meetings throughout the year, bringing up the occupancy there? If the meeting room is sitting empty, can we bring in group room revenue and give them the meeting room for free to incentivize to come to the property? So there's different ways to look at that. There's also biddings that happen that take place. Like if you're in major markets, such as Ohio, I don't know, big companies in your market, but let's assume 3M is in town and they're bringing in 1,000 room nights, right? We can negotiate directly with the corporate fixed rate for them to come throughout the year. And that's what we specialize in, is finding niche companies within the market and how to grow our sales team to be able to capture that revenue, whether it's group revenue, whether it's corporate revenue, to fully go after those products. So as soon as we are almost done with the PIP, we're going to go ahead and incentivize our sales team to go out there, meet these people in person, and negotiate a corporate rate to bring them in throughout the year. So that increases our occupancy as well. There's multiple ways, but from the expense side of things, it's been a very tough couple of years in hospitality space. In 2019, most of the limited service hotels we are looking at, you know, residents in town places, Hamptons and Fairfields and Holiday Inn Expresses, they used to average anywhere from on the low end, probably 30% NOI, and the higher end, probably 37, 38, good performing properties. Right now, we're seeing the NOI percentage drop anywhere from, on the low end, I've looked at probably 200 deals, 200 plus deals in the past year. The low end average was around 17, 18%. The better performing properties were coming 27, 28%. So it's been very tough. Our revenues have gotten back to 2019 and higher now, but also on the expense side of things, we have higher insurance costs now. We have higher payrolls. Cost of breakfast, linen, everything when it comes to operation has also gone up 20, 30%. And property taxes after COVID were reduced to help basically stay afloat. And now property taxes are getting reassessed in a lot of counties to normalize again. So our NOIs are still difficult to get back to the 33, 35% that we are looking for. And the way we can do it is through doing the value at ourselves and increasing the revenue and trying to go through each line item and see where we can make our impact.
Man, you're stressing me out. That's a lot to deal with. When you say NOI percentage, is that as a percentage of revenue?
Yeah, NOI is a percentage.
How has Airbnbs affected hotel occupancy?
In the markets I operated, we dealt primarily in secondary and tertiary markets. Primary market is where they saw bigger hits in the downtown corridor. But in the secondary and tertiary market, we have not seen much impact on the Airbnbs because the tourism market, the demand outpaced the supply. So there wasn't much of an impact in the markets I operated in the upper Midwest. I'm not really sure about the Carolinas or Sunbelt area and what the impact has had there, but just in the upper Midwest and the markets I operated, the penetration wasn't as much as it was in California or any other markets such as that.
Hey, are you guys allowed to charge whatever fees you want? And where I'm going with this is you look at the Airbnb price and you look at a hotel price, and it often seems attractive for maybe a two-night stay to stay at an Airbnb until you see all of those fees. So on the hotel side, you call how much is a room per night. You get the room or you get online, there's a rate. They don't add in all the surcharges and fees. Why can't you do what Airbnb does and throw on a $30 cleaning fee per night?
Our fees are mandated by the brand. They're very strict now. If you're charging some sort of a secret fee, Hilton or Marriott or IHG is going to come down on you and probably get that fixed right away. So we cannot have a lot of hidden fees or any of that structure. Only fees that we could potentially add on is the ones I mentioned to you, is pet fee or anything that are the guest is aware of. So it's very strict on the fee component side of things.
What's trending now are no-name boutique hotels that to me are like glorified Airbnbs. They take old motels and put a coat of paint on them, give them some trendy name, add some cool amenities, and have automated systems so that there's no hotel clerk, and now it's a boutique hotel. What are your thoughts on those?
Boutique, depending on the market, it can be very successful. I've talked to a couple of boutique owners, and their model can work because they're cutting down expenses. Franchise hotels, we have to have a 24/7 front desk clerk to help out at any given point. I'm just not sure how the operations and how maintenance will take place, because I've had properties I used to manage and be a GM, and I'll get a call at 3 a.m. that the guests can't get into their rooms. So how are they going to be able to take care of those kind of issues right away? Because usually when we have a front desk person, I can call them, I can give them the instructions, like go get this key, go do this, and get the guest into the room. If not, give them a different key and just get the guests taken care of. It's 3 a.m. If you have the rooms available, let's take care of the guests first, and we'll figure out everything when the maintenance crew comes in the next day. So from a boutique hotel perspective, they are able to convert some of these mid-scale properties and get a higher revenue. And they're able to cut down expenses as well because their overhead decreased. They cut out breakfast. They cut out, there's no such thing as housekeeping on everyday basis, usually like once every 7 days if they have an extended stay. So their overhead and their NOIs are a lot better. My concern would be on the sales side and how that's going to be valued and what buyer pool you're going to be looking at when it comes to selling the property. Because when we enter any property, and I'm sure you are aware as well, when you're buying property, you have to have at least 2 to 3 sales exits prepared day one in case if anything happens. So I just don't know, and I'm not familiar with the boutique concept enough to know where my sales are going to fall or how I'm going to be able to exit the property.
We'll get back to the show with first some sponsors I'm confident you'll find value in learning more about. If you're an investor like me, you're probably looking for one platform to manage the banking and finance needs of your entire portfolio. The good news is there is one. It's called Baselane, and it's the number one banking platform built for independent real estate investors that reduces busy work so you can focus on growing your business. With Baselane, you can earn up to a 4.19% annual percentage yield and 5% cash back on debit card spending with no monthly fees. With a simplified view of your cash flow and expenses, you can retire those tedious spreadsheets. You can also manage unlimited virtual accounts and cards, and even open separate accounts for each property or unit. Join more than 40,000 real estate investors who trust Baselane for their banking, property management, and bookkeeping. Head over to baselane.com/Joe and sign up today for a chance to win a $500 Amazon gift card. That's baselane.com/Joe.
I would think those boutiques are more in touristy areas where they essentially sell themselves. But if you were to take a 50 to 75 unit hotel, would you ever buy one that's not branded and have no intentions of branding it? Just run it as independent?
Yeah, I can definitely do that if the market demand is there. So to your point, if it's in a tourist market where we have revenue 12 months out of the year and we can sustain it and get the rates we want and the occupancy we want, yeah, we can definitely make it work on a boutique hotel. That way we're not paying franchise fees, which can be anywhere from 10 to 14% depending on your negotiations with the brand. You can save that and it goes right to your NOI.
What about South Dakota or Ohio that are not tourist places? Would you ever consider buying a non-branded hotel that's 50, 70 rooms?
I grew up in South Dakota.
Right, and that's why I picked on you.
Exactly. South Dakota, it's tough because we do have tourism on the Black Hills side of things, but that's only for summer months. So in the winter months, what a lot of these people do in the smaller towns is they just winterize the hotel and they leave. So they just close it down. So you could utilize that model. If it works for you, you just have the hotel open for, let's say, 8 months out of the year, and you close it off for the winter months for 4 months, but you're going to run into logistics issues, right? How are you going to find employees that are only going to be willing to work 8 months and not 12 months out of the year? How are you going to be able to afford to pay their payroll even when they're not working with you? So you're going to run into the logistics issues as well. But I would take on a boutique in South Dakota on specific markets, like our bigger city, Sioux Falls. If it was a boutique hotel in the downtown corridor where we can go ahead and get corporate clients we need to sustain our weekday revenues, I could definitely do a boutique in downtown Sioux Falls, for example. But
got
in
it.
Smaller cities or tertiary, I would not be able to sustain.
Okay, so there has to be something to attract guests to come to that area into that property. Why are you transitioning to multifamily? Is it too stressful in hotels?
Multifamily has always been on the back of my mind. Before I joined DeRosa, I was underwriting multifamily properties within the Midwest as well and just learning about the components of it. And back to your point, it also comes to a liability point. I was hands-on in COVID. In COVID, we saw revenue drops of 90%. Some of our properties on a trailing 12 saw drops of about 15 to 20% because we're in tertiary markets. The ones in secondary markets saw the revenue drops of 40%. In primary markets such as Minneapolis, people are down 60, 80% in revenue, anywhere in that range. So that's why I was like, all right, hospitality is still a good space, but need to venture out. And that's where multifamily made a lot of sense from a risk perspective. And also from a management perspective, it's a lot more hands-off. Once you do the CapEx and the acquisition, you can roll it for another 8, 9 years before you have another CapEx due after that. Also from a buyer pool, hotel is a smaller industry compared to multifamily. Multifamily, you have buyers that are willing to take on a $500,000 multifamily or $500 million multifamily project. As long as you're in the correct market, your buyer pool is a lot bigger on the multifamily side of things compared to hospitality.
Hey, because of the challenges that you mentioned in hotels, wouldn't this be a good buying opportunity?
Right now, it's just a bit challenging because the NOI percentage is not there, and that's what makes a lending hard on the other side. So I'll give you a couple examples. Right now, CMBS is coming down to about 60 to 65% loan to value, and they're going to ask a 300 spread on 5-year treasury as of today. Our credit unions, our local regional banks are going to be around that same 7.75 to 8% interest. but they're going to likely cover upwards of 75% loan to cost. They'll help you fund the CapEx and help you fund the PIP and the acquisition. But just based on the interest rates and where the numbers are right now, it's just hard to cash flow these properties, at least for the first 3 years, until you've done the full PIP and try to ramp up the revenue. So that's a difficulty we're running into. Other things are smaller properties are just harder to operate because you're going to need 24/7 front desk on a 60 property. It's hard to make it work compared to a 100 unit property. And a lot of the properties coming onto the market are usually in that range of 60 to 70 rooms. So we are looking for opportunities on a bigger scale, 100 plus rooms at least. First.
Are there any good property management companies for hotels?
There's a lot. Right off the hand, I know 5 or 6 of them. We have interviewed with all of them. We've sat down with them in person and everything. They have regionally established players. They can take care of the PIP. They can take care of property management. They can do full service hotels. They can do limited service hotels. They can do the hotels that we stayed at the Hyatt in Salt Lake City. They can do a conference room hotel as well. So there's a lot of regionally established players based out of Minnesota, Iowa, and South Dakota that are exceptionally well at what they do. And property management on a hotel is very similar to multifamily. You can find a lot of big players in any given market, such as Ohio, Carolinas, or anywhere. Only difficulty you might have is getting them to a tertiary market where the population is 10,000 or so below, just because the labor pool and trying to get managers or GMs to move to that might be a bit harder.
So if the cash flow is not really there, it doesn't make a lot of sense to buy a property, put a property management company in there, because the margins are taken away, right?
Yeah, because similar to multi and retail, property management can cost anywhere from 3 to 5% on the bigger boxes. On a conference room hotel, it might be a bit more because there's a lot more complexities involved. So it doesn't make sense. But at the end of the day, if you're buying a Hilton product, for example, and if you're a first-time buyer, you're going to have to use a property management company. Otherwise, you're not going to get the approval. Hilton, Marriott, IHG have a very strict vetting process where you have to showcase that you have enough financial strength, you have enough property experience, even if it comes from multifamily or retail, that you can take on this project. But as far as property management, they won't allow you to do it, at least until you have expertise and you can go ahead and apply for the property management license. So these companies have to be licensed through these brands to do property management.
I was going to ask you if you would recommend for the best ever listeners to look into investing hotels, but I have a better way of phrasing that question. Would you encourage your kids to get into the hotel business?
100%, yeah. We're looking at new developments right now. We just have 2 new development opportunities on our desk right now. We're looking at a couple more down the road as well. So hospitality space is going to get better. There's no questions about it. Travel and office, mainly corporate travel, is not recovered. We are hoping at least in the secondary and tertiary markets we're operating, it's going to recover at a better pace than the primary markets. So that's why our targets are those markets. And in terms of tourism overall, if you're in a tourism market, you can't really go wrong. You might even be able to convince bigger brands to keep your box for 50 to 60 years, given the brand, and given the location is prime. You can get away with those aspects. So yeah, in terms of hospitality, the returns are going to be there. It's just right now it's a little bit tough, but if you can do a PIP very quickly, take on bridge debt, your property is going to cash flow, let's say, a year from now. So it just comes down to what you're looking for and what your strategies for your growth. But opportunities are definitely there.
Yeah, but we should make no mistake about it. This is not a passive investment. You are a business owner. You just bought yourself a job, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of asset management involved on our end. When we're looking at properties, we're definitely going to have third-party property management companies. We do have our property management on the multifamily, but we're not going to step into hospitality space anytime soon. And that's just because we have to gain the expertise. We have to establish a portfolio. It's going to be 5-7 years building everything out before we even think about any of that. But from an asset management perspective, yes, there's a lot of check and balances I have to do on a weekly or even daily basis to make sure everything's offered correctly.
Hey, compared to hotels, multifamily's got to be easy, huh?
I wouldn't say that necessarily. No business is easy, not even retail, as you're aware. There's challenges associated with any component of business. Hands-on operation, I don't deal with a lot on the multifamily side because I'm just in the acquisition. I get to step away after we've acquired the property. But asset management team, you know, they're still very heavily involved with the multifamily side as well. making sure all of our needs are met from the property management side.
Why are you not on the asset management side of multifamily if that's where a lot of your experience is?
I like acquisitions. I like to do numbers. I like to have a form, you know, planning out for 10 years and everything ahead. Acquisition just suits my strong suit because I like working with lending on a foremost basis. I like working with brokers, seeing where the needs for new development is. We can build a community together, let's say in a secondary market. So it's just more towards my niche instead of, I've done property management. That's why I want to say I like acquisitions a lot better and doing the development side of things. But on the hospitality, I will have a more active role in the asset management.
You mentioned that you couldn't stand sitting behind the desk in the corporate job. It sounds like that's what you're doing now with acquisitions. You're sitting behind a desk.
I was on the road 2 days last week. I have another property tour coming up this week, actually tomorrow morning. I'm also traveling a lot to go look at new sites, new developments as well.
Okay.
So it is a more active.
Got it.
Compared to just sitting. But yeah, when it comes to Excel spreadsheet, I have to be in front of my laptop and make it work.
Okay. So you're not just hiding behind a computer on acquisitions. You're visiting properties and walking them. Okay. Yes. What are you doing to acquire properties? It's a tough market out there, isn't it?
It is. So I have a lot of relationships within the core states we're looking at right now, Upper Midwest. I have relationships in Iowa, Omaha, Kansas. So I'm utilizing a lot of those to see if I can find off-market deals. Second, we have built enough relationships with brokers for the past 5 years that, you know, if there's any opportunity off-market or even we're one of the first ones to receive those opportunities. Right now, the deal flow has increased tremendously. And then the past 4 months compared to last year, I want to say the deal flow is almost 2 to 3 times. That's why we underwrote 5 hotels last week. We're underwriting probably 3 hotels this week. That's where my property tour is tomorrow and everything to encompass them. So deal flow is a lot better this year for sure.
Are you on the acquisition side for hotels and multifamily or just hotels?
Both. Yep. So Irvi, Francois, and I work together on both multifamily and hospitality.
I love that you have multi-asset background because as different assets ebb and flow, you can be opportunistic and focus on whichever asset yields a higher return, right?
Exactly. And that's the point of diversifying DeRozan's own portfolio into hospitality and multifamily. Currently, we do have a new development deal that is live right now on DC18, which is 36 new development, because DeRozan has been value add is what our portfolio has been, is buying 1970s, 1980s build, CapEx value add, same as a lot of other listeners and people from Best Ever. And now we're stepping into the new development field on the multifamily side. We're also looking at new development hospitality side, and we're also looking at value add on the hospitality side. So yeah, it does open up a lot more deal flow for us and opportunity as well.
You know, at the Best Ever conference, we had a pitch slam and there was a gentleman who was converting hotels to studio apartments. Have you looked at doing any hotel conversions?
We have, yes. We saw opportunities in some of these long-term stays, extended stay products that were built in the 1990s. We saw a good opportunity in them because the square footage was a lot bigger than what it is in current builds. So we looked at those components and we looked at the costs associated with them, where they're trading right now. And the analysis is because of the bridge debt required to make it happen. We'll definitely look at it in the future as well. Let's say interest rates are a bit, probably a year from now, we can look at that again. But like I mentioned to you, if a hotel is not performing well, it's still going to trade based on the price per key. And the price per keys are still high on the extended stay products. Those are still trading upwards of 100,000 plus per unit. So it's hard to convert them and get your value out as well.
And when you say extended stay, that means that there's little kitchenettes inside the units, right? Hey, what about those no-name hotels or vacant hotels that don't have any kind of kitchens, just a room and a bathroom, converting those to memory care facilities? Because you have the security of these residents not being able to wander out because there's typically just a few entrances and exits in the hotel. They're easily monitored. Have you seen that work or have you considered that?
I have a couple of friends that did assisted care, but not memory care. They did assisted living. And what happened was their ratio was about 70%. So like if you have a 100-room box for ADA compliance and redoing fixture, they had to cut it down to 70 rooms, add the kitchen component to it as well. And they were successful in that venture for sure. It's just, I don't have that expertise and neither the DeRosa right now, so we are not looking into that opportunity. We're primarily fixed on the expertise we do have in-house at the moment. But I would definitely look into it if people are open to it and willing to learn. It's definitely feasible, I would say.
What's been your most difficult challenge transitioning from hotels to apartments?
The most difficult component was just learning how the debt side on multifamily is such a bigger market and there's so many more options available to you, such as Freddie, Fannie, or in hospitality, we were constrained to, on the better side, CMBS or regional banks. But on the multifamily side, there's a lot more you can do and a lot more different ways of utilizing it. So that was a very big learning curve. Other than that, it took me about 2-3 months to go through about, I want to say 60 to 70 P&Ls and get familiarized with the languages that are in different P&Ls, learning what each OPEX ratios are for different kinds of buildings, like 1960s versus 1980s versus 2000s, Class A versus Class B, what the different OPEX ratios on those would be, what the NOI expectations versus the rent expectations. But that was just a part of the learning curve, which was expected. But yeah, the lending side is what blew my mind, was the amount of options available on the multifamily side.
And you have expertise in hotels, multifamily. Have you guys considered retail or office?
We have considered retail. Retail would be a usually probably mixed development. Let's say if you have a hospitality component, if we could do retail on the first floor and have the hotels up above, that could be very beneficial. I've seen that model in a lot of downtowns these days where they have a restaurant, or CVS, or some sort of pharmacy store and a couple more retail components. And the hospitality front desk is on the corner and up and the rooms above it with the parking deck. So yeah, we have looked at those opportunities in terms of retail. Have not looked at strictly retail or industrial for sure.
Hey, what is your best investing advice ever?
Best investing advice is you're always in it for the long term. You might not make your money in the first 3 years, but it might be year 10 where the property is going to be there. So as far as real estate goes, it's always going to be a long-term game. You cannot build a portfolio in 1 year. You have to invest yourself. You have to learn about the industry. You have to keep on top of all the information available in the market data. And you have to always look at it from a long-term play on what you're trying to build over the next 10, 15 years.
All right. Hey, let's dive into the best ever lightning round. What is the best ever book you recently read?
I just read a book on Tremel Crowe called Master Builders. It's an amazing book. I'd highly recommend it. That's more on the real estate side. On the mind and body side, I just read Inner Engineering. So that was really good and helpful as well.
What was your big takeaway from the book Master Builders?
Tremel Crowe basically designed a lot of the components we're seeing today. He was, I don't know, say visionary, but he was a lot ahead of his time. If we compare warehouses, he knew what the demand for the warehouses and how to bring people in, and he was able to scale that up. If people are from Dallas, they'll definitely know Tremel Crowe Center. They definitely know like the 7 and 10 buildings he's built around there, the warehouses he's built. He changed the entire skyline of the city, which is astonishing to me, that a person born in the Depression era, I think a fifth or sixth child, very minimal background, and I don't even know, Crowe Holdings is probably a 20 billion plus company at the moment, and it's probably one of the biggest development companies.
Hey, what's the best ever way you like to give back?
So there's three things I focus on when giving back. One is financial literacy and education. Second would be food security. And third would just be overall volunteering and helping and spending the actual time instead of just donating. It's more of hands-on being there. The financial literacy component is just teaching people basic finances, how they can grow their money and just be a lot better safe in today's environment. Food, man, nutrition, I take that very heavily when it comes to homelessness or helping out wherever I can with the pantries and whatnot. I'm still young, so it's going to be a couple years before I can step more into that field.
And hey, how can the best ever listeners reach out to you?
Yes, you can reach out to me through DeRosaGroup.com, or you can reach out to me via my LinkedIn as well.
Well, hey, it was a pleasure meeting you at the Best Ever Conference, and I was intrigued with our conversation about hotels. Thank you very much for coming on, educating me and the Best Ever listeners on all of your experience with hotels. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Best Ever listeners, thank you for joining us as well. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review. Share this podcast with someone you think can benefit from it. Also, follow, subscribe, and have a best ever day.
Hi, Best Ever listeners. Joe Fairless here again. And one last thing before you go, would you like to receive a short weekly email with proven tips from experienced investors, free tools and resources, and a roundup of the week's most relevant news and Best Ever content? Well, if so, join the community of nearly 15,000 commercial real estate passive and active investors who receive the Best Ever newsletter. Just go to bestevercre.com/access. And you'll get the very next one. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you for listening and have a best ever day.